from that discussion about 10 minutes or 5 minutes after 3, so we can handle what I think will be a relatively minor and supported Senate Resolution Number 1. The purpose of this meeting today is to take a look at the major cases affecting Alaskan resources that are out there in the hands of various courts, and there are literally millions of dollars and millions of acres of land that are involved, and I thought it might be good not to get certainly into areas where we would be having privileged information, but just an overview of the status of the cases and what some of the impacts might be on future development. And with that, I wonder if we could ask the Ron Lawrence to come forward, identify yourself for the record, and we'll leave it up to you, Ron, as to how you'd like to present this. We appreciate your being very responsive to the committee's request.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We're very happy to be able to put on this description of some of the major cases that are being handled by the Department of Law in the resources area. We sat down and talked a little bit about the best, most informative, maybe most interesting way of being able to present it to the committee. Identified the cases that we thought would be of particular interest to you, and also felt that perhaps by bringing in individual attorneys who are most closely involved with them, we could keep the cases a little more interesting. And to the extent, or the description's more interesting, the cases are interesting by themselves, but to the extent you've got questions, probably be able to answer them more quickly and more directly by having the attorneys most closely involved responding to them. So I will have one case that I'm going to describe to you that I was involved in myself, and then turn it over to another one of our attorneys to give you a description.
Just to get a little idea of how many cases will you be presenting to us today?
We've got about 15 cases to give you an overview on. In terms of one of the things I wanted to just describe real briefly for you was to give you a sense of how that compares to our workload generally in the resource area. Statewide right now, we are handling in the litigation area just about 230 different cases of litigation. So when we're describing 15 to you, that's less than 10% of the total.
But you picked the ones with the most major impact.
Exactly, uh-huh. Exactly. I just wanted to give you some idea of the rest of our workload in that area. We have considerable resources within the Department of Law, attorney resources devoted to these cases. We recognize their importance today and the importance of these kinds of cases in the future as well. They are not just sort of here today, gone tomorrow disputes. The outcome of them will last for some time.
One additional thing before you begin. It would be interesting to know whether or not these were more or less generated as people go through by conflicts in, say, federal and state law, or by, say, the inability of through the legislative process to resolve conflicts. Just to give a little idea of how we got to where we are.
Okay, we'll try to get each of the attorneys to look at that particular question, discussing their cases. The one case that I was involved in, just to give you a little background on, is a case called South Central Timber versus Wanneke. Originally started out against Commissioner Loresh when he was the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. That was a case that challenged the constitutionality of the state's primary manufacture requirement in the sale of state timber. In other words, the requirement that the state imposes in selling timber that it must be processed in some way within the state before it can be exported either to a foreign country or to another state. In most cases, the timber that we're talking about in the state of Alaska that belongs to the state of Alaska would be processed in the form of cans. In other words, the round logs would be cut into large pieces of lumber before they could be taken outside the state. That was challenged by a potential bidder on a sale in the ICK region who did not have in-state processing capability. Said that it was an unconstitutional requirement, a burden on them, and a burden on commerce, interstate commerce, and that therefore the requirement should be struck down. The requirement was in fact struck. This was filed in the federal district court. The requirement was struck down by the federal district court in Alaska and appealed by Alaska to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which reversed, finding that the requirement was constitutional on the basis that in that court's view, the U.S. government had given its approval to the imposition by the state of Alaska of that kind of requirement. The federal government imposes an identical requirement with respect to sale of federal timber in Alaska, and the Ninth Circuit Court said, since the Alaska, both the purpose and the requirement are so close and parallel to the federal requirement, we find that the federal government has implicitly authorized the imposition of this kind of a requirement. South Central Timber then appealed that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court heard it last, just about a year ago, and ultimately reversed on the narrow ground that the federal government had not, in fact, given authority to the state of Alaska for this kind of requirement. The court went on to address a related and a legal issue as to whether or not there might be some other basis under the U.S. Commerce Clause for an exemption for the state of Alaska, but that issue wasn't decided. There were only 8 members of the Supreme Court sitting on that case, and it was a 4-4 split decision. Sent it back to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit has sent it back to the District Court. The case is still in litigation on the underlying issue as to whether or not primary manufacturer requirement with respect to state timber can be imposed by the state of Alaska. At the present time, there is still a preliminary injunction in effect, which blocks states imposing primary manufacture. In fact, the District Court in Alaska has now issued what it considers to be a final injunction prohibiting us from imposing it at all in the future, but we have now appealed that aspect of the case back to the Ninth Circuit. The case is still going to be going on for a while.
All right, so right now, on private lands, there's an injunction against imposing that?
This only applies to state lands. It has no application to private landholders, and it has no application, of course, to the federal government when it sells its own timber. The federal government still imposes the primary manufacturer requirement. It only applies when the state of Alaska is selling timber on a state land.
Fine. Apparently no questions. Unless there is, we'll move on to the next case.
At this point, I'll turn it over to Larry Spangler of our office, who will talk to you about the Madison decision dealing with the subsistence issues.
Fine. Thank you. And we do have, as you know, a meeting scheduled for 8 o'clock at the request of the administration to go over the Madison decision for not only this committee, but other members of the Senate. And then also to hear from the governor's proposed legislation. Larry?
Thank you. I have here a brief memo outlining the Madison decision and its effects, which we could talk more about tomorrow, probably. I thought it would be useful, though, for you to have it ahead of time and follow along now. The Madison case is a state Supreme Court case that was decided at the end of February, and it arose out of some lawsuits in Cook Inlet where some people from Homer and from Kenai had sued the state claiming that they had not been adequately protected under the state subsistence law in the way the boards were implementing it. The case wended its way up to the Supreme Court over a several years period. In the meantime, the board continued to implement the law the way it had been implemented. And the Madison decision will have significant impacts on the way we do regulate fish and game under the law as it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court. The state subsistence statutes require two things, that if subsistence uses exist, they have to be authorized, and that if there is a situation where restrictions are necessary, subsistence has the priority. Before Madison, before this decision, the way that boards had been implementing the law was to protect rural Alaskans, to authorize uses for rural Alaskans under the subsistence law. And because subsistence harvests were limited to those rural harvests, there was adequate fish and game left over to accommodate commercial uses, sport uses, and personal use fishing, which was a category of net fishing for people from Fairbanks and Anchorage and non-rural areas. That method of operating had been certified as being in compliance with the federal subsistence law, ANILCA. Now, Madison evaluated, it's the first time that the state Supreme Court had evaluated the way the law was being implemented, the state law that was being implemented, and the court ruled only on statutory construction, not on any constitutional grounds, and determined that the way the boards were implementing the law was not consistent with what the legislature in 1978 had meant by the law. The court said the legislature had not meant for rural people to be benefited, and had not meant for uses to be identified on a community basis. The result of this decision is that all Alaskans, it appears to be that all Alaskans may engage in subsistence fishing and subsistence hunting, and that those uses may not be restricted until non-subsistence uses, commercial, sport fishing, and personal use fishing have been eliminated, and on the game side, until big game guiding has been eliminated and non-state resident hunting. This paper lists, this memo lists several examples of where that will come into the real world. So that is one result of the Madison decision. The other result is that the state Supreme Court has now said that we do not have a statute that defines subsistence uses as rural uses, which is the way the federal law defines it. And the federal law says that if we do not have a definition that allows us to protect rural uses, some sort of federal management will follow. And I suspect that you'll be wanting to hear about this in a lot more detail tomorrow, so I'll just stop unless there are questions.
I'm sure there are. Senator Halford?
Yeah, just 2 points. You said the Supreme Court said that we could not manage subsistence to benefit rural residents. I think what they said is you could not use subsistence in the first tier to benefit rural residents exclusively. And there's a substantial difference there. In reading the case, it seems to make the distinction in the two-tier system and the one-tier system very clear.
That's true, and I was being simplistic for the sake of brevity. Once commercial fishing and sport fishing have been eliminated, then the board can distinguish among people based on where they live. But you can't use that rural criterion until those other uses have been eliminated.
Senator?
Is that elimination for a particular resource area, or is that statewide? Meaning if you didn't have enough salmon for the subsistence harvest in Southeastern, would you have to eliminate the commercial salmon harvest in Cook Inlet?
No, it's for a particular fish stock. If there are, if a particular fish stock or a particular game population is the subject of subsistence uses, the use of that game's population or fish stock couldn't be restricted until commercial and sport use of those particular stocks or populations had been cut back.
So the probable areas of conflict are Cordova, Copper River, and Upper Kenai, or Upper Cook Inlet, Kenai River.
And Susitna Drainage.
Upper Cook Inlet.
Yeah.
One further question. You also said that our law doesn't allow us to meet the conditions of the Federal Act. Would not a two-tier system, which is entirely permitted under our law, allow us to meet the conditions of the Federal Act?
It is. There is an argument we could make that under the second tier, we would try to benefit rural people, and therefore we could argue to the solicitor's office that we would be in compliance. And I've talked about that with them on the phone already, to some extent. There is a problem with that, which is that the Supreme Court has recently said that if you have three factors listed in a statute that you have to use, then you have to use all three. And in the subsistence law, after sport and commercial are eliminated, then the law sets out three criteria that you use to distinguish among people: local residency, alternative resources, and direct dependence. So you couldn't, it's very possible under this recent Supreme Court case that you couldn't just use local residency. You'd have to use the others as well. And that would mean that some rural Alaskans would be cut out at the same time. It's a possible approach, but this recent Supreme Court case makes it less likely to work. It's not one that I would want to write off because we may need to look at that more closely. But it's not unshaky.
One final question. It seemed that the Supreme Court said what a number of people were saying before we ever went to the ballot with this issue and everything else. But now that we're in the situation we're in, how do we go back to our constituents and say, for example, with regard to the hunting, where the method of take is the same, and now all Alaska residents basically have a priority over non-residents? How can we go back and justify to them that we want to add back in the non-resident take over them?
That's a policy question that I guess isn't really a legal question as to what the proper outcome is.
It seems that in all the debate on the subsistence issue, it was going to go to the people who were really going to eat it. The Supreme Court said that, and it said that, as it happens, guides and commercial fisheries and sports fishermen who don't eat it don't have a priority. But all those residents of the state of Alaska, regardless of where they live, have a priority if they eat it. And if you have to distinguish between those people, then you can distinguish on the basis of local residency after you've eliminated the commercial uses of those resources. And we're back at square one.
Senator, that's true.
But that's exactly what we told the people.
Well, I hope that tomorrow you will, in the presentation, bring up that that issue for a little bit of exploration, because it's a, that's an important one. Are there other questions on this particular case? And we'll be looking, I guess, for legislation coming down on Wednesday on that.
The next Assistant Attorney General that will address you is Deborah Vogt, who will talk about the TAPS cases and some other similar matters.
All right, fine. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Hi. Could you identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Deborah Vogt, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Oil and Gas section here in Juneau. I have a prepared summary of oil and gas litigation that I will be talking about briefly. Around. The primary person responsible for the state's oil and gas litigation effort is Bob Maynard, who is out of town today, and he has asked me to present a summary to the committee, which I will do to the best of my ability. One of the cases is specifically mine, but to the extent that there are more detailed questions about the matters that Bob is handling, I'm sure he would be available for any questions in the future. The state is presently involved in probably one of the most massive overall litigation efforts in the field of oil and gas undertaken by any state in the United States. The questions in this area involve the basic question of who owns the oil, and Tom Custer will be talking to you about the disputed lands case and the submerged lands issues and so on. What is the value of Alaska's oil, and whether the method used by Alaska for taxing that oil is constitutional. The valuation question is probably one of the most pervasive questions in the area, and it's complex and has several components. Alaska North Slope oil, as you know, is not sold on the North Slope, so that unlike Texas, where you have a posted field price that tells you immediately and currently what the value of that oil is when it leaves the ground, North Slope crude is sold in distant markets after transportation components, and it is sold, most of it isn't even sold. It's transferred from the production arm of a major refinery, a major oil company, to the refining arm without a third-party transfer. Some of the oil is exchanged with other oil companies, and those exchanges may or may not include components other than price in that exchange agreement. The valuation question has, as I say, several components. The transportation costs are, of course, you have to go to the distant market, figure out what the oil is worth, where it's disposed, either in the West Coast or the Gulf Coast or in the Caribbean or wherever it goes, and then bring that value back to the North Slope by deducting transportation costs out to arrive at the North Slope value. The distant market valuation is complex, as I said, because of the fact that much of it is transferred to self-owned refineries and some of it is exchanged. But the state's involvement in oil and gas revenue revolves very significantly around the question of valuation. The severance tax is levied on the value of North Slope crude at the North Slope. The royalty share that we get is also tied to that value. The United States is interested in that value for windfall profit tax purposes. And the state, during the years in which it used separate accounting, used North Slope value as the starting point for that tax. The TAPS tariff case is a major component of that overall valuation picture, in that the amount charged by the oil companies for moving the oil from the North Slope to Valdez is, of course, a deduction from the West Coast or Gulf Coast disposition price, so that in a netback process, the TAPS tariff is taken out to arrive at North Slope value. The TAPS tariff case, which Bob, I believe, will be addressing you about more specifically later on, again, itself involves two issues. One is the proper methodology to use in setting the appropriate tariff, and the second is what are the appropriate numbers to plug into that methodology. Methodology phase of the TAPS case has been put on hold. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has apparently indicated that it's not real interested in resolving that case. The factual side of it, phase two, which includes the appropriate cost of construction, is immensely complicated factual issue. The trial has been completed in that phase of TAPS, and it is presently being briefed in front of an administrative law judge. As you are all probably no doubt aware, the state is in the process of attempting to settle this case and has in fact settled with ARCO. Bob is in fact on TAP settlement business out of state right now. The remaining valuation questions are at issue in several other lawsuits, which are all interrelated in that they revolve around the same questions. There's the ultimate question of what is the actual value on the West Coast or in the Gulf Coast, and that we have involved ourselves in, for example, a California antitrust case in which California and the city of Long Beach are alleging that California crude oil producers have artificially deflated the price of California crude. Since Alaska crude competes with California crude on the West Coast, we are peripherally interested in the resolution of that case and have succeeded in being allowed to review the documents that are being produced in that case. More to the point, the Amerada Hess case involves the valuation for no-slope royalty purposes. And there again, there's more than one issue. There's the issue of the ultimate destination proper value, plus the issue of the proper tanker charges, which are to be deducted in netting back.
Deborah, if I could just interrupt a second. Before you move on in the tax case, and we will have that before us next week in depth, but this is the first time I've seen, or at least noted, the figure. You're talking about for every dollar per barrel change as a result of the litigation, that would mean $3.75 to $4.5 billion in present-day dollars.
Over the life of the field,
over the life of the field.
Yes, and that can involve either the ultimate valuation question, is the West Coast price proper, or the tanker charges, or the payoff charges.
That's very significant.
The TAPS tariff case itself, I think Bob has estimated that the high case and low case expectations in that case are between $7 and $10 billion over the life of the field. I think that's on page 7 of the materials.
Very good. Excuse me for interrupting. Go ahead. You're on the Amerada Hess.
Quite a record. So Amerada Hess involves tanker charges and the question of the ultimate value of the oil in the market in which it is disposed. Peripheral to those cases is litigation with Alaska Oil Company over the state's royalty oil, which it sold some years ago and is attempting to collect some $62 million in what we assert are underpayments of royalty purchase price. The reason it's related is that the Alaska Oil contract uses as a price term the term the Amerada Hess price, so that Alaska Oil is somewhat pendant to the Amerada Hess case. The Amerada Hess case has been pending since, I think, 78, and we are this year involved in a massive discovery effort which will result in literally millions of documents which will need to be analyzed by the state. And we are in the process of setting up a computerized document processing system to handle all the documents associated with all these cases, which are all interrelated. Pretty much separate from all of those cases is the case which I've been handling, the Oil and Gas Corporate Income Tax Litigation, ARCO v. State. That suit involves the constitutionality of the method chosen by Alaska between the years 1978 and 1981 for determining the amount of income earned by multi-state companies in Alaska. There are two basic approaches let me back up and say that whenever a corporation does business in more than one state and a state attempts to or imposes a corporate income tax on that business, some method must be devised for determining how much of that income was earned in the taxing state and how much of it was earned elsewhere. There are two basic approaches to that problem. One is called separate accounting, in which the in-state activity is viewed as essentially a separate entity doing business at arm's length with related divisions and other components of the same corporation. That's the method which we adopted in 1978 and which was in effect for four tax years through 1981. The other method, more commonly used throughout the United States and used by Alaska for other types of taxpayers, is called formula apportionment, in which rather than trying to separate out transactions between one division or branch of the company and the rest of the company, you lump all the income together and attribute a portion of it to the state on the basis of a mathematical formula that uses the taxpayer's contacts with the state, typically payroll, property, and sales, and simply uses a formula to say, for example, one-fifth of your payroll, property, and sales are in Alaska, so we're going to presume that one-fifth of your income was in Alaska and tax that. When the state changed to the separate accounting methodology, the oil companies sued, asserting that the formula apportionment method was constitutionally preferred, and additionally that the combination of separate accounting used by Alaska and apportionment by formula used by other states subjected those taxpayers to double taxation. This case was resolved on summary judgment at the lower court a year and a half ago in front of Judge Carlson, and has been appealed to the state Supreme Court. That argument was made. I argued the case last September. We could expect a decision any time now until the next, between now and 18 months from now. The state Supreme Court can do one of three things with that case: either uphold the state on the law, find against the state on the law, or find that it was inappropriate to grant summary judgment at the lower court and remand for a trial. There are approximately $2 billion that we collected during those 4 years, and unlike the rest of the oil and gas litigation, this is money that we already collected and we already spent, so that we do face, should we be found wrong, a fairly large liability in that case.
I think that's important, that this one does differ from the others in that the state is at some degree of risk.
Yes.
The other is risk in terms of potential dollars.
That's right.
This is in,
that's right. All the rest of the litigation improve the status quo. This litigation can maintain the status quo or lose money, yes. The $2 billion that is presently at issue is essentially collections of approximately $2 billion less alternate tax liability. The present tax law would be retroactively imposed, plus interest. And the retroactive tax liability, should today's method be used for those 4 years, is about $600 million. So that leaves about $1.4 billion of actual potential loss plus interest on that, which gets you back up almost to the $2
billion. Senator Lass.
I'm curious, who initiates the losses if the state is pursuing in relation to the tariff? Is that Commodity Department of Revenue or Attorney General's Office or a certain group? Someone has to make a decision.
To which case, though, Senator?
Any of the cases that the state is involved in.
The corporate income tax case, the taxpayer sued us just about as soon as the legislature finished enacting the law.
I'm not interested in that. We're saying that we're being shortchanged, whether it's transportation oil or else the market value. Someone has to initiate those suits originally.
Right.
The Attorney General's Office or?
The state initiated the royalty litigation, the royalty valuation Amaretta Hess case. Alaska Oil, I believe the state initiated that when the purchaser didn't pay up on the contract. The TAPS tariff litigation, I honestly can't say how we got involved in that, whether we initiated the litigation or I would assume that we did because it's very important to us.
They say we.
The Attorney General's Office.
I'll say that's on direct orders from the governor, and I suspect that's when it comes to decision time, the governor is the one that would say, well, let's pursue it.
This is going back in history before my involvement with these cases, perhaps around Lawrence.
Mr. Lawrence, can you comment to that?
Of course, it's going to depend on the magnitude of a particular case, but when we're talking about cases of this magnitude, that I think ultimately what you're really looking at is a recommendation by the Attorney General to the governor, laying out the terms of a particular case. Certainly not every case that we initiate on behalf of the state of Alaska gets referred to the governor, but when we're talking about large sums of money being at stake, we want to make sure that he's aware of the litigation that we're taking to the state.
Well, those are the cases we're talking about here, isn't it?
These cases, are yes. I could not tell you whether with respect to each of these cases we actually, some of these cases go back 3 or 4 years, whether we actually referred to the governor, each of them or not.
I'm just interested in what the process is. Someone has to make that final determination. I know it's not the legislature. So somewhere along in this whole process, someone has to, some committee or some person says, well, let's go to court.
In most cases, it's going to be the Attorney General exercising his judgment as to whether or not it's the kind of matter which he should inform the governor of before he files suit. I think that's the best answer I can give you without talking about specific
cases. Well, Senator Lassen, you bring up a very interesting point because many times the obviously the outcome of that affects the budgeting process. And now in a case as large, say, as the tax settlement, previously when the legislature took action against the settlement at that time, and now with the issue before us, both times have been brought to us by the Attorney General because it's very substantive and has a major impact, so they come to us. But a lot of times you're going to see in just an item in the budget that goes through the finance committees to settle a case. It's never been really acted on in terms of the legislature saying go ahead. So it does, obviously, the decisions bind the state, and sometimes very substantially. So I guess that's always a judgment call, it must be, as to when they decide to go ahead and when they accept the settlement. It's a major issue you bring up.
And there could be, you know, brings up some other points, too. What ones have they decided not to pursue, and for what reason? So what we see is what we read in the newspapers when it comes to litigation, and we pay the bill. But
that was one of the interesting reasons I wanted to bring it. For instance, I think when we get into submerged lands, and I don't want to take away from the future, we're talking about 5 million acres or so of land, and you've already heard just these cases, total of something like $15 to $20 billion. Well, that does make a little bit of difference on what we have to spend. So I don't see that out of this meeting will come necessarily any specific action, but these things tend to get away in the courts and we don't see them. So you might save some of those questions and we can ask them today. If we don't get answers, why I want us to feel comfortable about pursuing it further. Senator Cogdill and Senator Farrenkamp.
Follow Senator. Question one step further. Is there a menu on the ones that haven't gone to court? Is there any? Is there a group of areas such as have we tackled the AG case with the Interior with the Secretary of Interior yet to get him to put the money back into the escrow account?
AG
case
is next.
All right, that's one we're going to be discussing, is that correct?
The only cases I, for example, personally have knowledge about would be revenue taxation questions in which we have reached a settlement with a taxpayer rather than going to court against a taxpayer, and that would be a situation in which the state analyzed its the strength of its position against the taxpayer, and the taxpayer moved, and we moved, and we decided not to pursue it in litigation.
May I suggest that the kind of generic questions that we save to see if they're going to be touched? If not, we'll get the people here to answer either today or to follow up. And I think that's an excellent one. What happens, you know, what's that list out there? Senator Cogdill?
Well, I follow them. On the litigation of the tax case, what are you looking at? Another 10 years before we get a resolve on it? We've been at it now.
Right. I think the tariff case could be expected to go on for quite some time if it's not resolved in settlement.
$35 million to date. Senator Farrenkamp?
Well, I would just respond to Senator Mason's question on the cost of litigation. In the discussion of the court cases, when we had an active joint oil and gas committee, those things were brought up often before the oil and gas committee, and it wasn't just isolated. Governor AG's office, we were very much involved at those times before they split up, before we decided not to have
one. I don't think I'm getting the answer I'm looking for. I don't believe that the Attorney General has the ability or the staff to make recommendations based that are really recommendations to come out of Rednor's. They're looking at an entirely different field than if you're pursuing through the courts. But someone has to evaluate what we're getting for our bad oil through the whole process. And I don't think it's the Attorney General's office. It has to be maybe revenue. We're getting changed.
Certainly the Department of Revenue is very closely involved in
the problem to start with, right?
Right. Both the Departments of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources for Royalty Matters are very closely involved with the AG's office in determining factual
basis.
Somebody
has to determine there's something wrong. It wouldn't be the Attorney General's office.
Absolutely.
You'd either pursue
Absolutely.
It, right?
Thank you.
And maybe my memory's faulty, but it seemed to me that in 81, whatever it was, 81, I believe, when we changed the method and went more to the formula, mm-hmm. It seemed to me at that time in testimony of the Oil and Gas Committee that there was some indications of settlement in favor of going to this legislation. Does anybody remember anything of that nature that the companies were saying that?
Senator Fernkamp, that was in 1982, I believe, wasn't it?
Just 81, I think.
81?
No, 80.
Well,
no. Well, we changed the legislation, 81, I believe.
I know it was effective January 1st, 82. I think it was assumed it passed in 81.
It was in 81.
There was discussion of a settlement that did not, obviously, proceed to settlement.
And I would just like to review some of those tapes. And top of a shell, just my own curiosity. I like to have some continuity of testimony before the committee and some follow through on what's given there. So.
A question on TAPS. You mentioned, Deborah, that FERC does not want to resolve the TAPS issue. What does that mean?
This is a question that Bob Maynard would certainly be able to answer better than I, Senator. Apparently, they have shown some reluctance to move forward quickly on the resolution of the methodology in the TAPS tariff case.
I'll wait till Bob is back.
I certainly know far more about it than I do.
We will be having a joint meeting with the House Oil and Gas Committee on Monday to review this in depth. So.
There are no further questions of me. The next person who was...
I believe you did not touch on, or unless that's going to be somebody else, the Supreme case in the Dinkum Sand.
That's right. Tom Custer will talk about that. He's the head of the Natural Resources section in the AG's office, and he will talk to you about disputed lands and other
fine.
Issues.
Fine. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Custer?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Tom Custer, and I'm the supervisor of the Juneau section of the Natural Resources Juneau office, or component of the Natural Resources section in the AG's office. Perhaps I should begin by saying the cases that I'll deal with primarily relate to either submerged lands or revenues therefrom, and perhaps the place to begin is with Senator Hockhill's comment with Section 8G of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. Section 8G of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act provides basically that when the federal government leases those lands that are seaward and outside of the state's boundaries, that the lands that are within 3 miles of the state's boundaries, that is 3 to 6 miles beyond the coastline, when the federal government receives revenues from those lands under statute, the Section 8G, it is required to provide the states with a, quote, fair and equitable share of those revenues that it receives. Now, that's a pretty nonspecific directive from Congress as to how much that money is, how much of that the money they receive from those lands actually is a state entitlement as to go to the state. For several years, the federal government didn't turn anything over. They thought that was fair and equitable. They said the states own their lands and the federal government owns its lands, and therefore it's fair and equitable that the federal government gets its money and the state gets its money. Two Gulf states, Texas and Louisiana, said, wait a minute, that's not what Congress meant at all. The amendment to the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act that inserted this provision was in 1978. Subsequently, both Texas and Louisiana sued and won significant victories in federal district courts in that part of the country, basically saying that the federal government's lands were farther offshore than the state's lands. The state leased its lands first, which gave oil companies a considerable picture of how the substrata looked as one went offshore, farther offshore, and that therefore the bids that the federal government received for its lands that were farther offshore were significantly enhanced as a result of the actions that the states had taken. In addition, there's a question of drainage. If the federal government happens to lease first, since oil and gas flows back and forth across boundary lines, it does not really respect this artificial line separating state from federal lands, it's very possible that the federal government lessees will drain oil from the state lands, and that therefore that also needs to be taken into account in determining what is a fair and equitable share. Now, as the recent federal OCS lease sales offshore Alaska have indicated, there's significant industry interest in the submerged lands offshore our state, and the revenues from this 3 to 6 mile belt are substantial. And the question is, what is Alaska's fair and equitable share of those revenues? We have been engaged in lengthy discussions with the federal government, and as the committee undoubtedly is aware, the governor is taking a very lead role in terms of coordinating efforts among other states on this question. The federal government has made offers which are piddling, nowhere near as substantial as we think our entitlement might be. We have not yet filed litigation because, in our view, with the two federal district court cases in Texas and Louisiana, there really is significant pressure on the federal government to talk meaningfully with states, and that this opening offer that they made, which was really rather insignificant in the neighborhood of 3% or something like that of the revenues from the area, is not really realistic. But that rather than file a lawsuit and, in effect, harden people's positions, because then, of course, the Justice Department gets involved in litigation when you're dealing with the federal government, that at this point we are still attempting to negotiate a fair and equitable result. Now, this is obviously a dispute between the state and the federal government arising directly out of a federal law. In terms of overall revenue, I cannot at this time provide the committee with actual figures, but hopefully within the week I will be able to get some from our attorney in Anchorage, Mark Wooster, who is handling the day-to-day action on this question. I can say at this time, though, that they are significant. The revenues we're talking about are several millions of dollars and perhaps hundreds of millions that we are seeking.
I'd like one question in clarification. Okay, the state has received certain funds, and Senator Ferguson has put in bills dealing with some impact funds. Is that from a different case or a different law? What is that law, Senator Ferguson?
Madam Chairman, that's from a law that was entered both into Congress, both the House side and the Senate side, and in which Senator Stevens from our state had one of the bills on the Senate side. That's been in existence about 3 years. It went as far as Conference Committee, and it's a method of how they share lease monies and those kinds of things as they come back to the state, whether they go directly to the area impacted or if it goes through the state to the area impacted and is dished out. It's a federal law that included both the coastal states and the offshore and the lake states. And the reason for putting the lake states in was to try to garner the votes in which to have the impact funds. But it's a different situation, really, from this lawsuit.
What's given me the confusion on that, that it was my understanding that there is, I realize the issue is back before Congress, but there were apparently funds in an account for this. Is it the potential funds that are in some account?
There's $30 million.
$30 million.
That's already in an account. You correct me, Tom, if I'm mistaken on this. This may not be in your area, is it?
Well, Madam Chairman, if I may, there are two programs under which the state is. Actually, there are three programs under which the state is currently receiving revenue sharing funds from the federal government. One is not strictly revenue sharing per se, and that is federal government assistance to coastal states for their coastal management program. And we are receiving federal funds for that purpose through appropriations generally to the Department of Commerce, which oversees the coastal zone management program. They are not based on revenue sharing of any specific federal revenues. It's just general straight congressional appropriations funneled through the Department of Commerce to the coastal states for purposes of the Coastal Zone Management Act. The second revenue sharing program, which is currently underway, is the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920. Under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, the state receives 90% of federal oil and gas revenues from federal uplands. The federal government, we brought suit against the federal government in 1976 because they were decided that we weren't entitled to any of the revenues from wildlife ranges, like the Kenai National Moose Range. And they cut us off, even though they had been, you know, transmitting these revenues since 1964 to the state, or actually since statehood to Alaska, 90% of those revenues. We brought suit against them in 1976. In 1980, I had the privilege of arguing in front of the United States Supreme Court that we were entitled to those revenues, and by a 6-3 vote, the court concluded that, in fact, attempt to change this 90-10 split, in dealing with revenues from the wildlife range, but that's the current distribution system that would occur if the law remains unchanged and significant commercial deposits of oil and gas are found in the wildlife range. The third revenue sharing program is a specific statutory program for revenues the federal government receives from oil and gas leasing in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Under the NPRA Revenue Sharing Act, the state receives 50% of those federal revenues. In addition, the federal act provides that in dispersing those revenues, in appropriating the revenues, the state must give consideration to those political subdivisions of the state most directly impacted from the oil and gas leasing activity in NPRA. And that may well be the legislation that Madam Chairman and Senator Fernkamp were discussing, is the NPRA revenue sharing account, which was set up last legislative session. And as I understand it, there now are some questions about actions the state took between the time it became entitled to these revenues in 1980 and the establishment of that account, special account for tracking these revenues once they've been received by the state.
That's one I'd like to take a little look at to see how that is being carried out. All right, now, your next piece.
Okay, if moving on from AG, we might move landward into the case that is nearest and dearest to my heart, and that is the Dinkum Sands case.
Just a moment.
Before we get inland, let's stay on the OCS.
AG.
AG. As I understand it, the Secretary of the Interior has offered the state 16 2/3% and they put a $1.7 billion into the escrow account, but they're not following federal law. I wonder is the state tracking them? There's been no monies put into the escrow account by the federal government, and there should be billions in there. And even though it's just a paper transfer, there should still be tracking, Tom, and they should still be in there. Is there any, because part of that, the state's position is that's not enough, we want at least 50%, as I understand it. I agree with that position.
That is correct. And the problem with the escrow account is that nothing in law that I'm aware of in Section 8G requires that an escrow account be established until that amount, until it is determined what is the fair and equitable share.
I thought that it was in there that it all had to, that all funds had to go into the escrow account until such time as it was determined what was going to happen between the several states.
I don't believe so. There's nothing in Section 8G. As I say, all Section 8G requires is that the states receive a, quote, fair and equitable share. It's very nonspecific. And,
but with the current situation on the federal level, I mean, we're liable to get a note to share in the federal debt before.
I agree with you entirely, Senator, and certainly that is one thing because
it's money, it's big money.
That's something that the administration and the governors of several other states collectively have been pressuring the federal government for, and that is the establishment of an escrow account to ensure that when this amount finally is determined, the federal government will have the money to pay for it. Now, with respect to an offer of 16 2/3%, I cannot speak definitively whether that, in fact, has been made. I know that an offer of some funds was made by the Secretary of Interior, at which time the Director of the Office of Management and Budget said, well, we're not so sure, because he's the one who, on the federal side, actually controls the purse strings and tries to deal with the national debt and ways and means and so on. So while the Secretary of Interior may feel 16 2/3% is fair and equitable, David Stockman might not.
And we certainly do.
And we do not. We certainly do not. So there are a number of different positions depending on which branch of the federal government you speak to, and at this point, none of them are acceptable to the state. And perhaps that's the best way to say it.
I've asked one more question on that. On the cases that Deborah brought out, and on the last page, on page 9, is U.S. versus Alaska, U.S. versus Alaska.
I'm just going to touch that one right now.
I'm ahead of you. I thought that
we're
that
on
was,
to Dinkum
I think
Sands.
We were still on OCS, though. This is the Burford Seed Plan.
Right.
In the Burford Seed.
And Senator Cockhill, the relationship here is that we are moving from the stretch of land that ranges from 3 to 6 miles offshore to the stretch of land that ranges from 3 miles offshore to the coastline.
Okay. All right.
And if you understand what he's saying,
he's saying
that's our land.
That's our land.
Okay. That is our land.
I agree with you.
By way of brief background, in 1953...
Who disagrees with us?
federal government.
As one might expect.
Let's let Tom have his crack at this one.
Very briefly, by way of background, in 1953, Congress passed what's known as the Submerged Lands Act, and it conveyed to the states all of those lands within 3 miles of its boundaries. In 1959, when Alaska achieved statehood, Section 6M made the submerged lands applicable to the state. So Alaska now owns all the submerged lands within 3 miles of its coastline, or within its boundaries, however they may be defined. Now, the rules for determining the boundary between state-owned and federally owned lands are quite clear where you don't have any islands, because then you just go 3 miles from the mainland. But where you have a string of islands, they're nowhere near as clear. In fact, they get rather confusing. The general location of the suit that is currently at issue is shown up here on the map. It's directly offshore Prudhoe Bay. The pink lands are the ones that are in dispute. The yellow lands, everyone agrees, are owned by the state. The genesis for the lawsuit was the joint state and federal oil and gas lease sale in 1979, which from the disputed lands generated bonus bids of $451 million. Those leases are all sliding scale royalties, beginning at 16 2/3% and then increasing the larger the size of the commercial discovery. So if it is a whopper on a particular lease tract, the landowner could get as much as 67% of the production from that. So we're talking $451 million cash, as of 79, plus production royalties if there are commercial discoveries. As of December 31st, the escrow account, and here we do have an escrow account, with interest had reached $981 million, slightly over $981 million. And by my very rough calculations, that means that as of today, we have just topped $1 billion at issue. So we've got $1 billion on the table plus production royalties if we are successful in the litigation. Now, there are two major issues involved in the Dinkum Sands case itself, in what used to be the Beaufort title challenge, and now I think Dinkum Sands is a lot more fun. The global issue, or the larger issue really, is when you have a string of islands, and representationally, if the mainland is here, and there's sort of an arch of islands over it, and the center of the arch is more than 6 miles offshore, if it's 8 miles offshore, for example, then by going 3 miles from the mainland and 3 miles from that farthest island, there's still a little bit of room in between. So you end up with
inland water,
with sort of an enclave. You end up with an enclave, and that's precisely the question, is what are those waters and what are those lands? Now, our view, of course, is that where the state's 3 mile boundary following the mainland, and then when it reaches the first island, the island goes out 3 miles and it goes all the way across like this over to the other side and then takes off again. The state's boundary is out here. Congress granted to the states in the Submerged Lands Act all the submerged lands within its boundaries. Now, there may be an enclave here, but in our view, that is still within the state's boundaries. Now, the Outer Continental Shelf authorized the Department of Interior to lease all the continental shelf that is, and I'm quoting from the Act, seaward and outside of a state's boundaries. Now, it defies imagination to say that this enclave is seaward and outside of Alaska's boundaries. It's landward and inside, and I don't think the most creative sophistry in the world is going to change that fact. Nonetheless, they've got some creative sophists that work in the Justice Department. And
we're not the Supreme Court, but you're doing a great job. That's wonderful.
Well, I am definitely a true believer. I am a true believer at this point. The case has dragged on for what some people may think is an interminable time. It was filed in May of 1979. A motion to intervene was filed by the Inupiaq Community of the Arctic Slope and Upiagbek Inupiaq Corporation. The Inupiaq Community of the Arctic Slope is an Indian Organization Act entity representing the North Slope. Upiagbek Inupiaq Corporation is the Anxo Village Corporation for Barrow. Their ground for intervention, I thought, was rather interesting. They said that the Native Claims Settlement Act extinguished Aboriginal title in Alaska, but it didn't extinguish it outside Alaska, because we're talking about the continental shelf here. This is really a boundary dispute between Alaska and the Inupiats, because they have exercised dominion and control of the Outer Continental Shelf from time immemorial, and therefore they have Aboriginal title to the Outer Continental Shelf.
That's a new twist.
So the special master finally granted them very limited intervention. We persuaded the master that this is not really a quiet title action, it's a boundary determination. And so what he did is he said, well, I will let the Inupiats participate in conjunction with the United States on the boundary question, but I will not get into these questions of aboriginal title because it's not a quiet title action. So that is not present before the court at this time.
Do you have any idea how is the case proceeding, and do you have any hope that there might be settlement within a foreseeable period of time?
I think there is hope for resolution, but probably not settlement. The Inupiats were granted intervention in January of 1984. The master finally issued his order granting them intervention in January of 84. We were, unfortunately, unable to sort of go through the legal mechanics until we knew whether they were in or out. We were able to do a considerable amount of factual investigation and, fortunately, had the support of the legislature to the state's Department of Natural Resources to do a great deal of very costly technical and surveying-type activity on the North Slope with respect to a specific island in this chain known as Dinkum Sands. Dinkum Sands is the top island of this arch. So if you look at the handout, the little map, Dinkum Sands is in the very center. It's the one where the three-mile belt that it would generate is cross-hatched. So you can see that it has a very strategic location in this arch of islands offshore. If it does not exist or is not an island such that the state does not own the three-mile belt around it, the argument can be made that the state's boundary goes up and then it goes in like this and it goes back around and then it goes out that way. If Dinkum Sands does exist, then the state's boundary clearly includes these submerged lands in this so-called enclave. Dinkum Sands is a very small barrier island. It was first hydrographically surveyed in 1949. We went to trial last summer, finally, in the summer of 1984, after we knew the Inupiats were in, on the Dinkum Sands question. That is it or is it not an island? We had a 14-week trial. We're currently in the process of briefing it. We had a 14-day trial. I'm sorry, not 14-week. 14 days of trial, and our opening brief is due a week from Friday. It took quite a while to get the transcript of a 14-day trial back.
This is with the Supreme Court?
It's under the United States Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. They have appointed a special master as the judge, and his name is Keith Mann. He's the academic dean at Stanford Law School.
And this is heard then on the West Coast?
It's heard in Palo Alto. We've been using the moot courtroom on the Stanford campus for trial. And so that's where I was for 14 days last summer. The evidence in the Dinkum Sands case was very, very interesting. What emerges is that if anything is there above the water, it's very small. And there's clearly a gravel formation, a barrier island, as you were, the surface of which is very, very close to the appropriate vertical elevation, which is mean high water. But it is extremely close. We're convinced that we demonstrated that it is, in fact, an island, and it therefore counts. The federal government's theory of the case is that it is sort of a now you see it, now you don't, ephemeral, Atlantis-like entity that has no rhyme or reason. It just, one day it'll pop up over there, and then it disappears. And the next day it'll pop up over here, and then it disappears. And it'll be gone for several years, and then it'll pop up again. Well, we went through and got a number of expert witnesses, including three of the most eminent oceanographers and climatologists at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, to show that Dinkum Sands is one of a whole string of barrier islands, and that the processes that work on all of those islands, most of which are conceived by the U.S. to be islands, are the same as the processes that work on Dinkum Sands. And so that as long as they remain there, Dinkum Sands will remain there. And if they go up and down, so will Dinkum Sands. We think that we gave the master, or put Dinkum Sands in its proper perspective in terms of what is going on there, what explains this, processes in the real world are not totally irrational, at least as long as human beings are involved. If it's merely geophysical processes, there's a rational explanation, and we think we demonstrated that there is in fact a rational explanation for why Dinkum Sands is there and why it will continue to be there in the future. And therefore that he ought to conclude that it in fact is an island. With respect to the larger issues then, if Dinkum Sands is an island, we think the issue is clear. These lands are landward and inside, not seaward and outside, and therefore they belong to the state. In that regard, a case came out of the United States Supreme Court 2 weeks ago, a case entitled United States versus Louisiana, but the states involved were Alabama and Mississippi, dealing with the ownership of Mississippi Sound. Mississippi Sound has the same geographic configuration, a string of barrier islands more than 6 miles offshore, an enclave in between, and the U.S. Supreme Court held that that is, those lands indeed are owned by Alabama and Mississippi and not the United States.
Right.
We filed an amicus brief in that action and would like to think that we at least assisted the Supreme Court in reaching the correct result.
And can you ensure that if there's a shipwreck out there that we can stand on Beacon Sands and we'll be safe when they come to rescue us?
I cannot assure you that, Madam Chairman, but I can say that one of our experts, a man named Robert Llewellyn, who has spent virtually all of his working life, has a PhD in earth sciences, spent all of his working life consulting to oil companies on how to deal with barrier islands and to make things work on the North Slope, said that if there, in fact, was a shipwreck and you were close to Dinkum Sands, you sure would beat it to Dinkum Sands to try to stay safe. So.
Another point of interest on that, I imagine when they did this one with Louisiana, Mississippi, is what happens when there's a typhoon goes through there and moves those islands all around.
That actually was not a specifically asked question, but we think it's a very good analogy, and we have been arguing in our case that that coastlines do migrate. They do not stay static.
Yeah.
They move as a result of natural processes and natural forces. But that in no way detracts from the fact that this is indeed an island.
I have been sure one more question. Who is your expert on the AG situation up in the AG's office?
You? No. A man named Mark Wooster in our Anchorage office is the attorney handling it.
Mark
Wooster. Like the Worcester sauce. W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R.
Very fine, Tom. Do you have other cases for us?
I have a few others that I'll try to get through, and I don't want to run the committee over.
One
Moving from offshore submerged lands to onshore submerged lands, we come to the navigability cases. And under the Equal Footing Doctrine, which is not the Submerged Lands Act, but a constitutional doctrine under which the state, as an incident of assuming state sovereignty and statehood, gains title to all the submerged lands underlying navigable waters within the states. We have a significant amount of litigation currently underway against the federal government to determine which lands, in fact, are navigable and were conveyed to the state under this equal footing doctrine as an incident of statehood and therefore, first, do not have to be selected by the state under the Statehood Act if we wish ownership, and second, cannot be conveyed by the federal government to third parties.
I'd like just clarification before you go ahead. In other words, if we were granted the total of 105 approximately million acres of land and we won these cases, we would actually have 110 million or
somewhere,
whatever.
It depends on who you talk to and how the computations are done,
but it would be
the estimates are between 2 and 10 million additional acres would come to the state under the equal footing doctrine. These are all lands that are landward of the coastline, so that does not include this three-mile belt all the way around the state. The major cases under navigability deal with, first, how big must it be before it's navigable? And then what kinds of evidence can you use to show that it, in fact, is navigable? Now, the general test for navigability is that it be useful or susceptible of use in trade and commerce. We have argued that, for example, the Gulkana River is navigable because it is susceptible of use in trade and commerce. Now, most of the navigable waters that we have evidence on were used in mining and other extractive resource industries, where rather than try to build a new road somewhere, they would put things in a boat and carry it upstream in a boat. A number of those the federal government has not wanted to litigate because the facts were just too clear in our favor. So what we've really been doing is sort of trying to look for test cases where we could apply a little more creative legal theories to determine navigability, one of which was just were ruled against by the Ninth Circuit a week ago, and that is Slop Bucket Lake. We argued that Slop Bucket Lake is used so extensively for floatplane traffic, and that floatplanes are a means of transportation in Alaska by water, and that therefore, because of the extensive floatplane use at Slop Bucket Lake, it should have title to the bed should have come to the state under the equal footing doctrine. The district court and the Ninth Circuit both ruled against us, and the question we're now debating whether we should seek Supreme Court review of that.
Senator Sharenkamp first, and Senator Crockett.
Does Slop Bucket Lake then, and that navigability by floatplane, which has been one of the major things that we've been trying to get, you know, help discuss that. Does that in any way affect the ICE and the ICE traffic on Commerce?
No.
Where is that? Are we in any case that affects ICE Commerce on some
yes,
streets that are not big enough for the other?
Yes, we are. That is another one of the test cases that we've brought, and that is whether winter use of the riverbed for ice travel. Everyone knows the story of the man who rode his bicycle to Nome by riding primarily across frozen rivers. Whether that counts, that has not come to trial yet, but we expect it to. A third one is the use of recreational boats, inflatable rafts, canoes, conceivably even kayaks, although I don't think we're at this point, in the words of the right stuff, pushing the edge of the envelope on that issue.
Senator Farragut.
Well, when it says commerce and transportation, that commerce aspect, you know, a lot of that was done even by wooden rafts, but I think that's highly essential, and particularly in its relationship to 2477 trails and those being a part of them in certain parts of the year. So I don't know, are they using any of the 2477 trail concept in this lawsuit?
I'm not aware that we're using any of those concepts in the navigability lawsuits because
well, some of that navigability, how they can work it without using the ice with those parts that were used on lands and ice, really would tie in very closely.
That's an interesting thing. For instance, in the what's the area, the Independence Mine area, they came down off the mine, crossed Nancy Lake, went on up into the interior, so it was a winter route, but you can identify by air now that particular trail going through, and it disappears and takes off again. So I think that was probably true in lots of areas.
Well, you know, there's some of us that are old enough to remember that we didn't get to towns except in winter time, and we even graded the ice across College Road, University Avenue. We went to the edge of the creek and then took up on the other side of the creek, or to get to your town, Senator Tocaglia. No way we ever got to Dean Adam, other than that Trayton was driving a mile and a half down the ice. So, and the road was definitely there.
And
so
it was always interesting to see the
last
one. Surely
they can tie those together. Because if ice isn't, then we just have roads that go to a creek or a lake or a river.
So we're with you.
Senator Coghill, no, question?
Just a note, Betty, or Senator Farragut, that it was always interesting to see who was the first one across in the fall and who was the last one across in the spring.
Yeah, I can remember sitting. I can remember very well a pickup truck of mine sitting in the bottom of the Chena River.
I was wondering.
All right, let's not get too lost here because we've got some more cases I want to
have. In fact, while Commerce and Travel, I'd like to tell me what I was doing there.
Okay.
How far back can you go in here with litigation on navigability and commerce and trade? Will they have missed you all the way back to documents that we have in Swatka or Allen or the early history area of the state?
Absolutely.
Okay. You've got your
historical
records of pulling flatboats with horses up to places beyond Wiseman, and you have an awful lot of commerce and trade in the kayak, what you call a kayak, what we call a canoe, and are all of those, if those are admissible, my goodness, you've got the exploration of the North Slope by several of those whalers up there.
Absolutely. And I must say that these cases, as you can imagine and as this discussion is bringing out, are very fact-intensive cases. And when looking for those old records and trying to garner as much evidence as possible, there are a lot more false leads than there are finds. And so it is not particularly efficient in terms of the time spent, but we are, in fact, spending the time and turning over every stone that we can in searching for the factual evidence that we can use to buttress our claims. In addition to factual historic evidence, we are using everything at our disposal to persuade the court that even if we don't have the facts that it in fact was used at one time, that the physical characteristics of the water body itself would lend itself to use if anyone ever wanted to. and that that alone is sufficient even in the absence of evidence of historical use.
I'm going to allow one more question, but I want to tantalize you with the fact we have the Susitna continuing appropriation, the Szymanski Ninth Circuit of Court Appeals, Native Sovereignty, Mental Health Lands, and the Statehood Acts elections in National Forest yet to come. Senator Graham Kent.
I just like to inquire if you're using the old military reports that are in the library from 1904 to 1949.
Yes, indeed.
Good.
Well,
and it shouldn't make it difficult just to find some of those for 2477s.
Tom, do you have other cases for us?
Yes, very quickly. The Mental Health Lands case is one that's generated considerable interest in the last few weeks. In 1956, Congress conveyed 1 million acres to the state, or to the territory, to provide a revenue source for the territory to assume from the federal government responsibility for the mental health program in the territory. Prior to that date, in the Organic Act, the territory was precluded from dealing with its mentally ill. It was exclusively a federal government responsibility. The federal government's paradigm for dealing with the mentally ill was to have the U.S. attorney bring in effect an indictment against an individual, have a jury trial to determine whether that individual was or was not insane, if found insane, bundled up and sent off to Morningside Hospital in Portland, Oregon, if found not insane, then released into the community with no treatment whatsoever. Congress thought this was abysmal, and properly so, and desired then that the territory assume responsibility for this program. The problem arose up to this point, Madam Chair. I should point out that we are in a conflict. We have been in conflicts with the federal government under federal statutes or federal constitutional equal footing principle. Here is one that we are in trouble, or at least in litigation, by virtue of state legislative action. In 1978, the Alaska State Legislature enacted a law which changed the designation of these lands from mental health lands to general grant lands. In other words, gave the Department of Natural Resources the directive to treat these lands as if we had received them under the Statehood Act and not under the Mental Health Enabling Act. The quid pro quo for that change in designation was a provision under which 1.5% of non-renewable resource revenues was to be placed into a special escrow account for mental health purposes. However, the kicker was that it was subject to appropriation. Since 1978, there has never been an appropriation of money to that account. Needless to say, the mental health community has been upset about that, what they view as a breach of a public trust for mental health purposes. In 1982, they brought suit against the state, arguing that the 78 legislation was invalid. The state was required to compensate the trust in money for any lands which it had not already disposed of, which were not still in its possession, and that henceforth these lands and revenues would be dedicated to mental health purposes. It doesn't take a mathematical wizard to conclude that if you have 1 million acres of land and it's worth $100 an acre, that's $100 million. If it's worth $1,000 an acre, that's $1 billion. If it's worth $10,000 an acre, it's worth $10 billion. You just add a bunch of zeros is what it amounts to.
Where's that at now?
The lands themselves? The lands are among some of the best that the state...
No, I mean, where is that? Is that
where's the issue?
Where's the issue
the
at?
The Superior now? Court judge concluded that the plaintiffs were right in one respect, and that is that the lands were dedicated to mental health.
That's right.
However, he concluded that they were wrong with respect to the 78 legislation and said, if the legislature determines that it wants these lands to be treated as general grant lands, that's well and good. It has that power. The problem is that it must pay for them by putting money into the trust. So under the current status of the law, our legal position in court is that the 78 legislation is valid. The legislature can make that determination as a policy matter that it wishes these lands to be used, in effect, for their highest and best purpose, as opposed to dedicated to revenue. But at the same time, if they were dedicated, then the legislature must pay for them. Now, in our view, what Congress intended to do was first not dedicate the lands to mental health. The language of the bill of the Federal Act says, proceeds from the lands shall first be used for the necessary expenses of the Mental Health Program of Alaska. We view that as saying that if you have revenues coming in from mental health, that you would first address the mental health needs, whatever they might be, pay for those programs, then if there was additional money left over, it could be used for other public purposes. That is, they are not dedicated exclusively to mental health, but mental health would have first call on those resources or those revenues. It now appears, at least, that the attorneys for the plaintiffs agree with us. At the time the lawsuit was filed, they certainly did not. But it now appears that we have persuaded them that, in fact, is what the legislative history demonstrates. Our next point in the analysis was that since the federal government really desired that the territory take over the program and take the federal government's place, since statehood and since the care for the mentally ill is a generally considered obligation of state government, that's what we have done. We have administered a mental health program. Now, it may not be the type of mental health program that the mental health community desires, but nonetheless, we have satisfied the obligation that Congress imposed on the territory and subsequently the state, and that is to administer a mental health program. We have proposed to the plaintiffs a form of settlement of the litigation, and with the chair's permission, I'll just very briefly outline what that proposal is. We have suggested that we appraise the value of the lands, and then without requiring an appropriation to pay for those lands, consider that we in fact had a fund of that size and determine what the earnings of that fund would be on an annual basis. At that point, the legislature would consider the mental health needs of the state. We would identify that proportion of earnings that would have been generated by this fund, that proportion of general funds, as the mental health income stream from which the legislature would first appropriate for mental health needs. We think this would satisfy the intent of Congress while at the same time effectuating the 1978 legislative policy of treating these lands as general grant lands in the sense that they could be used for their highest and best use, even if that use was a non-revenue generating use. In our view, it would satisfy Congress and satisfy the public policy of using lands for their highest and best use. We have not had a response from the plaintiffs, although there is at least some indication that they feel this is a positive step. They're unwilling to commit to agreeing, but at least it's a positive step that we have made some progress in getting off dead center and being at each other's throats. And that's gratifying that we have at least made a positive step. The Forest Service selection lands in Section 6A of the Statehood Act. Congress gave the state 400,000 acres in addition to the 104 million in Section 6B. The 400,000 were from state forests. They are to be used, selections are to be used for community, recreation, and expansion. We have made selections in the state forests, particularly the Tongass and the Chugach. The Forest Service denied them on the grounds that they were not amenable to community expansion or recreation, in most cases because they're more than 25 miles from a community. And we think that's preposterous. Anyone that knows the way people recreate in Alaska knows that we go far beyond 25 miles from our homes when we go out for recreation. And they also know that communities that expand in varied ways to accommodate the desires of people in creating their own communities. We have briefed and argued that case to the Federal District Court. It is now pending for decision. I'd like to add one last little note before I adjourn, and that is to say that with the denial of Hank Ostrowski's petition for certiorari in appeal of his denial of a limited entry permit, a subject which I understand this committee has heard considerably about in the last several weeks, we now have exhausted the major constitutional challenges to the limited entry program as it is currently established. And this, is I think, allows both the lawyers and the courts to breathe a huge sigh of relief. There are still a few cases pending, but they are not major fundamental challenges to the program as a whole, but to various portions and administration of the Act overall. I might mention also, in response to Senator Eliason's questions, that decisions in our office about which cases to pursue are made as an executive branch and not just the Attorney General deciding we should sue. They're made in conjunction and consultation with all of the state agencies. We do not have our own independent investigative branches in the Department of Law. We rely on our resource agencies to bring the cases to us, to bring the facts to us, and to give us the support in terms of proceeding and actually litigating these cases to hopefully a successful conclusion. In terms of the menu of cases that we have not brought, the perhaps one area that might be viewed initially as an omission is that we have never sued the federal government to stop an OCS lease sale after the 1976 Gulf of Alaska sale. That's the only one the state has sued to try to stop, and I think there are two reasons for this. The first is states have almost invariably been unsuccessful in stopping them with litigation. And second, by not litigating, we have fostered what we believe at least to be a much more cooperative attitude with the Department of the Interior in terms of getting stipulations into the federal leases that we believe are necessary to protect Alaska's coastal resources. So in terms of the menu of cases that have not been brought, that's the only important one that I can think of. And I apologize for going on at such length, and hopefully we'll still have time to get through the remainder of the agenda.
If not, we're going to reschedule because they're important ones. Thank you very much.
The next speaker will be Doug Mertz, who will discuss native sovereignty and particularly
time. Fine. Doug, before you go, Senator.
Tom, I just want to commend you on your presentation of wiseness. I think that we need more of this because people out there see these $35 million that's been put towards the tax thing and towards the tax litigation, you know, and they're not quite in a position where that they know where we're coming from. And I think that public information is very vital.
Well, I can certainly say that for myself, I am most appreciative of the support we've had from the legislature in the Dinkum Sands case. The factual gathering and surveying of this island cost approximately $2 million. And in litigation expenses, we've spent about $600,000 to date. But when there's $1 billion on the table, and we are proceeding in, I believe, a very productive and positive manner, my opinion, for what it's worth, is that it's money well spent.
Fine. Thank you very much, Tom. Doug, before you come up, I would like to take up one piece of legislation you have before you. The Senate Resolution Number 1 relating to the University of Alaska Foundation, and I might point out that all of the senators that are here happen to be co-sponsors on it, but this came as a result of the University of Alaska Foundation appearing before different groups of the legislature asking for some support of the program they had to take a look at what the research needs were, and they've gone out to the public, raised some in excess of $300,000, are doing an analysis of just what the resource needs of the state are. They did not come asking for money, but wanting our support for the project as it was going through. I don't believe we have, or we don't have anyone that particularly wishes to testify on it. I do have information from the foundation itself, and I would appreciate being able to take action today unless there are some problems with the legislation. Senator?
Madam Chairman, I think we're all very familiar with the legislation, and we've had our backup material, so I would move the bill with individual recommendation.
Do I hear discussion?
Ask and consent.
So ordered. Now, if you'll bear with me, we could take another 10 to 15 minutes to hear some of the rest of the case. Is that agreeable? Can you all stay?
He doesn't kill you.
Well, he may walk out the door at 15 after, but we could go at the very end at 20, and then he couldn't kill us. And Doug, if you're please come forward, and if you're not able to feel to cover it, we will reschedule and get you back here because we do have important topics, and I feel like we've been on a railroad train, but it's given us a good overview of some of the major things out there. It's all yours.
I can be very brief, Madam Chairman. I'm Douglas Mertz. I do most of the Native and Indian law in our office. We've had a number of cases recently that involve, in one way or another, claims of Native sovereignty or special privileges or considerations based on some aspect of the status of being an Alaskan Native, based on claims of either special subsistence rights, special rights based on Native religion, or cultural or traditional rights, as well as more generalized claims based on political status of a particular village or a group of people. Most of these claims, when they've come up in the course of litigation, have not gotten very far. We've seen most of them come up in fish and game prosecutions, where people have raised it as a defense to illegal taking charges. And by and large, they've gotten nowhere. The single real exception has been the successful defense in the Carlos case of the taking of a moose out of season for a funeral potlatch. Attempts to expand that have not gotten anywhere. Claims based on a more general sovereignty claim by village councils, either IRA councils or traditional councils, are something of greater concern, and we've had several cases where that has arisen. Why these are important is that if a village or group succeeds in establishing a particular area as Indian country, which is a status somewhat akin to that of a reservation, it means the state has only very limited regulatory jurisdiction. Jurisdiction over fish and game, for instance, it would have very little opportunity to regulate taking a fish and game, to tax tax land, tax natural resource extraction, or to apply other regulatory controls on natural resource extraction. The other aspect of it that is important is that within Indian country, the native government has the authority to exclude all non-members of the tribe. And right now it is not clear how much area would be within Indian country if anyone were successful in establishing an Indian country claim.
How many of those do you have right now?
How many cases?
How many cases do you have out right now?
I can think of four in which the claim has been made in some way. The only one in which it's very well along is one in which we are not parties. That's the Tyonic civil rights case involving the right of the village council there to prevent non-Indians from renting in the community. We have not become a party in that or sought to intervene because our position is well represented by the other people who are in it. That's been under consideration by the U.S. District Court now since last December, a year ago December. So it's it should be ripe for decision very soon. We should be going to monitor that.
Senator?
The reason why I'm asking is like the Venati tribal area,
right,
is one of them, and the Tetlin tribal area that are they are and yet they're not.
Right.
Is that correct?
They are former reservations. The reservation status was terminated by the Native Claims Act.
That's what I'm. And so, in order for them to go back for Indian country, they've got to sue the state or the federal government for it.
Well, they've got to get somebody to recognize it, either the federal government or a court. And they've been unsuccessful so far in getting the Interior Department to recognize that status by and large. So, one other way to do it is to bring these test cases.
Senator Farrenkamp.
It bothers me. Now, we have how many? We had only one reservation, right?
Now we have only one. At one time, there were six or eight. But under ANCSA, they were all terminated except Metlakatla.
Okay. I guess the thing that bothers me, and not in intervening, you say that the state's position is well represented in that case, but if one of those cases goes down the drain, then they're going to fall like dominoes, are they not?
It depends what the court is and what happens on appeal. That one, the Tyonic one, is before the district court now. I imagine that if it came out in a way that really threatened the state interest, we would be able to participate in the court of appeals.
So you're not a stop then from intervening at a later point?
Well, it wouldn't be intervention, but it would be filing an amicus brief. We could participate, in other words.
Okay.
Well, I was really interested in his Indian lands and in status, because as we look at the sovereignty issue, Indian land sovereignty are so synonymous, are they not? If you remember in the paper, it said the Venati have been cited as term sovereignty changed from Indian lands or Indian governments, and that, as I understand, was a mistake. We did not do that, right?
We did not call them.
You did not? What?
We have not acknowledged that the landowner in Venati, which is the IRA council, is a government.
And
did you recognize it as Indian lands or Indian?
They are lands owned by an Indian council. That is clear. But it's not Indian country in the sense.
That's
it's
what
a legal term
has,
of art.
Indian country.
Right.
Because it was reported wrong then in the papers, or not?
I didn't see anything that reported it that way, but if it did, it was wrong.
Oh, I did. Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why. That's the reason why I asked that question, because if that thing toppled over, and that's why I asked about how many you still had on, because that one has been adjudicated, but they didn't put it over into Indian lands. It just went that it's lands owned by a Native corporation.
Right.
Very good, Doug.
Those are the only general comments I had on the sovereignty.
All right, very fine. Did you have any, either the Susitna or the Szymanski case?
I can tell you about the Szymanski one.
Excuse me, before we leave sovereignty, are you involved at all in the Akyochuk issue?
I have been, yes.
Disincorporating. Right. Is that liable to bring anything to a head?
Yes, it is very possible. There is a question of whether the whatever succeeds the municipal government, say it's the IRA council, if they can be treated as a local government themselves. So it's possible that some litigation could come out of that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doug.
There's no white people there.
The
IRA council, in the fundamental sense that it is a traditional council, as long as it doesn't exclude anybody because of race, color, creed.
Right.